Okay, so I'm here with Peter David, who is most recently the author of Tiger Heart, as well as a number of comics. Would it be safe to say that you're the Joyce Carol Oates of the T.C. Boyle of comics? You're so prolific, you know.
Well, no, that's ridiculous. For one thing, I'm a guy.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Really?
They're despite rumors to the contrary.
Well, I wanted to ask you, first of all, about this notion of being prolific. Is this really being prolific, or is this really just the average rate of production that, say, every comic book writer has to have in order to keep productive, particularly with Marvel and the like?
No, I am truly prolific. I have four children. I've just tried to keep pumping them out. You know, I actually have a generation unto myself.
Yeah.
I have a 27-year-old all the way down to a 5-year-old. So,
yeah.
You know, that's good. In terms of my writing production, I think that part of what helps is that I can type 120 words a minute. So, therefore, I can produce work as quickly as I can think of it. So therefore, the thing that impedes me is not my ability to actually get it down on paper or on disc or whatever you would have, but simply my ability to actually think of this material.
Yeah.
And there's lots of people out there who are equally productive in comics. And I think that if given the opportunity, they could certainly turn out books as well as I do, that sort of thing. It's just that I've been doing that for well over 2 decades now, so I kind of have a head start on people who are doing primarily comic books right now.
Yeah. Now, in terms of discs, do you actually dictate at all? Because I know Bob Burton does that as a writer.
No, I don't dictate.
Okay.
It's all me. I just sit there at my keyboard and pound this stuff out.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to first of all ask you about using a universal construct for much of your work. I mean, this book, Tiger Heart, deals and delves into the Peter Pan universe. Much of your work for Marvel, you have this great universe to play with for that. Even Fallen Angel, which is drawn from Enoch, or inspired by Enoch. There seems to be this reactive nature to your writing, as opposed to, I guess, generating a universe from whole cloth. And I'm wondering if this is more of a kind of pragmatic way to keep up your productivity, or whether you find reacting to an existing universal construct like, say, the Peter Pan universe works better for you in terms of keeping the creative juices flowing.
I don't think I've ever thought about it in that defined a manner. I think it's more along the lines of that I write what is of interest to me. For example, I have had invitations to write Star Wars novels. Never really been interested. I mean, I enjoy watching things set in the Star Wars universe, but it does not particularly, you know, call my name. Same principle here. I've been writing stories set in the Star Trek universe since I was 14 years old.
Yes.
Hardly anything new. I grew up reading Marvel Comics, reading DC Comics. The opportunity to play in these sandboxes is a fantastic one for me. In terms of something like Tiger Heart, set in a Peter Pan universe, as it were, writing material that's set in other mythos, that builds upon things that have gone before, hardly unique to me. I mean, the staggering number of mythos that are part of Sandman, that are part of fables. You know, it's all right there. That doesn't mean that the product then cannot be a wholly original take on what has gone before.
Yeah. I mean,
building upon what has gone before, that's... we've been doing that for centuries. It's hardly anything that's new to me.
But
I mean, when we have John Steinbeck and T.H. White producing material that's set in the Camelot universe, as it were, that doesn't make them any less important works of literature.
But to draw so explicitly from, say, King Arthur for your Knights trilogy, that is something that is a little bit more explicit as opposed to something more oblique like, say, Fallen Angel, where there are specific parallels, but it's not entirely explicit along these lines. And I guess I'm curious about the notion of, if we all draw from some original construct, well then why, in your case, do you often draw from pre-existing characters or pre-existing real mythical,
right,
and legendary characters that we
real
all know.
Mythical,
yeah.
Legendary.
That's a great oxymoron.
Notion. I mean, when I think of Fallen Angel, I don't particularly think of Fallen Angel as being set in any particular universe. Yes, do we say that Bete Noire, the city that it's in, was actually the biblical Enoch? Yeah, I've said that explicitly. On the other hand, it doesn't necessarily depend upon that. I said that it was Enoch because I kind of like giving it that biblical touchstone. I felt that it gave it depth and breadth and a sense of gravitas, if you will.
Yeah.
But I could just as easily have said it's a cursed city.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that goes back to an original sin without getting particularly specific. You don't have to have read the Bible to know what is going on in any given issue of Fallen Angel. That's merely backstory. It's merely backdrop. Sort of apropos of nothing, a series of books that I wrote that were wholly original. The thing that I love about the New Frontier books is that although they are set as a backdrop against the Star Trek universe, most of the characters and situations that are in the that are in New Frontier are wholly original to the books. As a matter of fact, New Frontier was the very first series that Simon & Schuster did, that Pocket Books did, that was actually original characters. Paramount actually predicted that it was going to crash and burn.
Yeah.
They gave us the okay to go ahead and do it, but they said, it's probably not going to do well. Who knew?
Yeah.
I have a series called The Hidden Earth, the first book of which came out from Tor. That is the largest book in scope that I have ever produced. It has mythological creatures as its background, as its backdrop. But again, I like to think that gives it a certain degree of anchoring in the human experience, as it were. It is, I think, easier for readers to relate to things that they have some sort of common grounds for. It would be easy for me to write a fantasy series in which you have an elf and a troll and a fairy are all gathering together to cross the cosmos to get the mystic gem of Puknathar, because otherwise reality as we know it will come to an end. But it doesn't have any anchor for me. It doesn't have any touchstone. And if it doesn't have any touchstone for me, I have to think that's really not going to have much for the readership as well.
This is, interestingly, a Joseph Campbell notion to some degree, but at the same time, you reject the Star Wars universe, which is predicated upon this Joseph Campbell notion.
They're saying now that the Star Wars universe is predicated on the Joseph Campbell.
Well, the marketing predicate. People are, yeah.
Yeah, I've always been a little bit suspicious of that, to be honest. Understand, I've never sat down and talked with anyone about it, but, you know, like, say, George Lucas, but the background stuff that I've heard seems to indicate that Lucas came up with this material, and it was sort of after the fact that parallels to Joseph Campbell were pointed out, and thus did the researchers and the people who talk about the hidden symbolism and meaning in all things have such an impact on George Lucas that he kind of went, yeah, that's what I was going to do. I was planning it all the time. I am dubious about that. I have no reason to necessarily suspect that Lucas ever cracked open a copy of Joseph Campbell before anything that he wrote of Star Wars. It's just that there are certain recurring tropes in stories. I mean, how many stories that come out in literature have to do with father-son relationships or father or pupil-mentor relationships? I mean, it's just a recurring theme. That's why it was ludicrous, I thought, when Star Wars came out and reviewers slammed it as being a ripoff of The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
Because it was about someone from a farm community on a quest. Right? Even though, as Campbell pointed out, that's a recurring trope. Then when Willow came out, the critics slammed it as being George Lucas recycling Star Wars. No, he was just simply going back to the same fundamental tropes that Star Wars was based on and that any number of you know, great works have been based on. I mean, how far do we want to go back? Do we want to go... Everything's fine. Do we want to go back to Gilgamesh? I mean, which is really pretty much as far back as you're going to start.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to, you know, the heroic, epic thing. I mean, a lot of the stuff that you're going to see in Tigerheart dates back to Gilgamesh. You know, a hero who is very full of himself. And he's got a sidekick, as it were, who is actually far more down to earth and, is teaching him lessons of humility and reality. I mean, yes, is that in Tigerheart? Yeah, but it goes back to Gilgamesh as well. So we're going to say, you know, I'm doing stuff that's evocative of the very first tale that we have of heroic mythos. Sure, we can say that, but, yeah. You know, everything has its origins in everything else.
Everything is derivative, then?
Just about everything is derivative, although I really do have to think that what if Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger with twins is pretty damn original. I don't really see a lot of antecedent for that.
Yeah.
But I am actually curious because in this book, Tigerheart, you have aspects that are close to Peter Pan, but right. not entirely. You have Any Place instead of
Neverland.
Neverland. You have Captain Hack instead of Captain Hook.
Yeah,
and
subtle
the like,
I wasn't.
You know,
yeah.
things like that. And so it seems to me that part of the pleasure of this book for you perhaps involved retinkering the formula, I suppose. I mean, to what level do you take on an existing notion and decide, oh, well, I'm going to have to tinker with this construct a bit to get it right so that it feels right to me?
Well, it wasn't a matter so much of it feeling right. As a matter of that, when you're using James Barry's characters, they're James Barry's characters. These are characters who have withstood the test of time. I was a little bit uncomfortable with the notion of saying, well, Peter Pan does this and Peter Pan does that, because part of me thinks, who the hell am I to say what Peter Pan says and does?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, granted, I'm a writer. That's fine. But ultimately, between that and the fact that Pan and company were essentially only supporting characters to Paul's story, I ultimately decided that in this case, I felt more comfortable with doing it as a pastiche, figuring that if it was good enough for Philip Jose Farmer, it's good enough for me. So that, you know, it, to my mind, the book works better. I mean, it was something that was actually discussed at Del Rey. We went back and forth over the notion of, should we have it simply be Peter Pan and call the characters by these names, or should it be the pastiche characters? And I mean, I ultimately decided, and Betsy Mitchell, the editor, backed me up on it, that pastiche was really the better way to go, because it makes the book more original, makes the book feel like it has more of its own tone to it. I profoundly and profusely thank James Barry in both the opening of the book and the acknowledgement, because I'm not trying to fool anybody here.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes here as to whence the story derives. On the other hand, it also allows me to play with the notion that there are recurring archetypes, because in the book we say this story has been told featuring different people going by different names and will continue to be ad infinitum. And it's true. I mean, certain things become recurring. We have Batman, but before Batman there was Zorro, and before Zorro there was the Scarlet Pimpernel, and before the Scarlet Pimpernel there was Don Quixote, because when you get right down to it, Don Quixote has all the tropes of a superhero. He has a secret identity, he travels around trying to right wrongs, and he's got a sidekick.
Yeah.
You know, and a costume.
Yeah. But there's also this idea, because the Ormond Street Children's Hospital has been expressing notions that they own the copyright in certain countries. And
well,
they,
it's not
and
a notion. I mean, you know, it was something that was ascribed to them or assigned
depending
to them by
upon,
Barry.
Depending upon what side you stand, I'd be like, for example, there have been a number of lawsuits by Disney, by this Canadian writer, about whether people can continue to do these Peter Pan stories.
Yes, and the Ormond Street Hospital has lost every single lawsuit.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I don't think they're planning to sue us.
Yeah.
That would be silly, especially since Peter Pan has lapsed into copyright. And by the way, he's not in the book. That said, I do have every intention of sending a percentage of the royalties to the Ormond Street Hospital as an acknowledgement and thanks from where it came from, and as a means of a sop to myself in case I have any niggling guilty conscience over
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm wondering if these legal concerns factored into this particular decision, too, the notion of this copyright dispute over Peter Pan.
Not once the series lapsed into copyright, into public domain.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that, you know, that's, if it were 2 years ago,
yeah,
would have been an issue. It's 2008. It's not an issue.
Yeah. this notion of having so a percentage of the profits back to Ormond Street, was this a matter of, I guess, repaying the creators, or at least...
Repaying the creators' intent.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, the Ormond Street Hospital did not create Peter Pan. James Barry did.
Yeah.
But he felt strongly enough about money going to Ormond Street. So my attitude was, you know, if it was good enough for the man who wrote the book that inspired Tigerheart, then I'm perfectly happy to perform due diligence to the cause.
Yeah. There's also this interesting metafictional component to the book. You dabble in metafictional quite a bit in your comics, but with this, it's quite interesting because there's one moment in which you describe the journey being a rather traditional journey as opposed to some daring adventure and how they get out of a particular spot. I don't want to necessarily spoil the book, but one could also make the claim that, well, perhaps it's the responsibility of the author to make something that is banal actually enticing, or get them in a sort of daring do to the next particular spot. It's this interesting chicken and the egg argument that you bring up with this.
Take your word for it.
Well, I'm curious about how this came about. Was this a notion to emulate the narrative voice that is in Barry's work?
100%.
Okay.
Absolutely 100%. I mean, and it's more than just wanting to emulate it because that's how Barry did it. I wanted to emulate it because that's how Barry made it work. You know, I have read some of the other Peter Pan sequels, as it were. None of them, for me, evoke the magic and wonder of James Barry, and that is because none of them makes the slightest attempt to emulate Barry's work. Have you ever read the original play?
I read it a long time ago.
If you look at the original play and you try to go by Barry's descriptions, it's unproducible. It's unproducible because if you try to convey on the stage what Barry has on the script, it's impossible. The way his descriptions of Neverland and all of that.
Yeah.
It is physically impossible to stage. All you can do is do an interpretation of it. To my mind, what makes Peter Pan, the original, Peter and Wendy, work is that there's a dreamlike quality to it, to the narrative. You know, because with dreams kind of go in and out. You know, sometimes you're inside of yourself, sometimes you're outside of yourself. You see things from all different perspectives, from all different sides. You know, part of you is in the dream and part of you is your mind telling you what is happening, what doesn't happen. Oh, this is a dream that you're in because this doesn't make sense. Oh, but it can't be. I know that it's a dream. You know, you will find yourself having these sorts of arguments while you're in the dream state. That is what I thought made Peter Pan work so well, because when you have a story that is substantially set in a dream world, the only way to really make it effective is to try and emulate that sort of dream narrative. And that's what Barry does, and that's what I try to do. Do I purport to be as good as James Barry? Good God, no. If for no other reason than that he did it first, you know? And I am merely trying to imitate and emulate it. But I think that the way he did it is the only way that a story set in that dreamlike world is going to work. I also want the book to be attractive for adults to read to children. So by making the narrator his own character, as it were.
Yes.
That gives the parent some place to be, because the parent can make all these asides to the child, and it's right there in the voice of the narrator, and yet it makes the adult a participant in the story. I love the notion of people sitting down with their kids and reading them this book. You know, it's because I want it to be a shared experience.
There's also something, though, really conversational about the comic book strip and providing instructions to a particular artist. And it seemed to me that some of the instructions in terms of where we're going with the story were very reminiscent of your comic book strip as Barry. And I'm wondering if that experience of writing all these comic book scripts kind of played into this idea as well.
I hadn't thought about it consciously, to be honest. I mean, the thing is, it is the same fundamental notion that I, as the narrator, am endeavoring to tell a story to someone. So when I'm writing a script for the artist, I am really telling the artist and the editor the story. And sometimes in my panel descriptions, I will take a narrative style, or I will step outside of the narrative structure to say, this is what this will look like. And if you look over here, and by the way, this is why I'm doing this. So don't be alarmed that I'm killing off this character, because he's not really dead. He comes back at the end of page 22.
Yeah.
So don't panic. I mean, you know, there will be those kinds of asides. It may be that because I've written over 1,000 comic books, that's why the narrative style to Tigerheart came so naturally to me. I hadn't really thought about it before.
Huh. I mean, in terms of the actual prose style, it's totally different from the instructions in a comic book strip versus actually causing something to be read aloud. So is fiction a way for you to escape the constant dictation to an artist, in a sense, or
is it a means of escaping?
Is it a means of sort of?
I never thought that I needed to escape from telling the artist what to do, because that's part of the job of writing the comic book script. I think of it more, now that you bring it up, that the way that I convey a story to the artist in the comic book script is simply another tool in my writer's toolbox that I can use for telling a narration of something else. The more narrative tools that any writer has, the better he's going to be. The more ways that he can come up with to convey the story that he's trying to tell. You know, I mean, as we were talking about before, there's only so many stories you can tell. There's only so many concepts that you can, thank you. There's only so many concepts that you can explore. Once you get beyond the basic notion of man versus machine, man versus nature, man versus himself, once you get beyond those basic concepts, then you're down to style and technique, and not even necessarily what you're going to say, although hopefully you have something interesting to say about the nature of man and mankind, but it also becomes how you say it. And the more ways you have of saying things, the more ways you have of keeping your audience engaged.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask you about the notion of a character ensemble in relation to this idea of engagement. In Tigerheart, you have a few characters who crop up and have these little cameo appearances like Fearless, Earless, and the like. And this reminds me very much of how in your comic book universe you have this amazing
arrangement. Now, see, my favorite throwaway side character. What I love is when we have the Pika tribe.
Yeah.
And I have this warrior who I say his name is Pouring Rain.
Yes.
And I say the reason, and the narrator says, Pouring Rain, who, as was the case with all Pika males, was named after the first thing that his mother saw when she opened the teepee.
Yeah.
And a couple of graphs later, I have another warrior brave make a point about the boy. And Falling Rain says, ah, dog-licking self speaks true.
Yes.
And it was just a throwaway bit, but every so often, dog-licking self shows up later on in the book.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I think the writer that I am, that I was once upon a time, would have had half a dozen braves with stupid names. Because once upon a time, there was no joke that I could not drive into the ground. I like to think I've learned a little bit by getting some degree of restraint, so he's the only other Pika Brave that we actually name.
Yes.
But yeah, you want to try and fill out the world. You want to try and fill out the world and make it as real as possible. And all you have to do is look around yourself at any given moment, and presuming that you're living in some sort of relatively metropolitan place, you're going to see other people. And other people are interesting, and because every single person that you see has their own story, their own concerns, their own problems, whatever it is that's going through their heads, and they are what fill out the world. They are what make the world interesting. So when you are writing a book like Tigerheart, or even better, when I'm writing a book like Tigerheart, in order to try and give it as much verisimilitude as possible, you want to have every character come across as a living, breathing individual with their own concerns and their own point of view and their own problems that need to be solved. And some of them solve their problems and some of them don't, and some of them are just passing through and tip their hat and say hello before they go off panel. But nevertheless, if you treat everybody as real rather than even one person so much as a cardboard character, it really makes the world real. And when you're dealing with a dream world, which is what the Anyplace is, it's incredibly important to make it as real as possible. Because if you have a dream world and nothing seems real, the whole thing's going to float right off the page.
But what I'm curious about is this notion of character management in relation to sustaining the believability of a universe. Because in the comics, you have a set stock number of characters, and you have these side characters that appear. Some
Something else?
That you actually devise, and some that come from other books and the like. And this is interesting to me because it's almost as if you are sustaining almost this anarchic world. And I'm wondering exactly how you manage these characters. How do you pay attention to everything? Do you keep tabs on everybody, or do you just let everybody kind of inhabit their own particular quarters?
Are you talking about comic books or entire arcs? I'm talking about both, actually.
You know, because some people appear and then they disappear, and then they, or like you'll have a character appear for a number of issues and disappear and things like that. So it's almost as if you have a character who can be there to sustain some feeling or some aspect or some story element, and yet you then bounce around to another one that you've forgotten about, right. And it's this constant state of intriguing anarchy. Do you actually really structure?
I'd say it's more control. Do I run a sweatshop? Is that what you mean? I would say it's more controlled anarchy. I mean, any writer is essentially, his first job is essentially to keep control of the voices in his head.
Yeah.
You can tell the people who can't keep control of the voices in their head. They're the ones who are wandering around the streets of Manhattan muttering to themselves. Although, unfortunately, nowadays you can never tell if they're actually insane or if they're just talking on a Bluetooth. So it's incredibly inconvenient. But when I'm working in comic books, for instance, you will have your lead character. You never lose sight of your lead character. And ideally, what you have is a bevy of supporting characters who, in various ways, shape, or form, will be able to highlight certain personality aspects of your lead character. Okay? Who you decide to use in any given situation really stems from the notion of what particular things do you want to have your lead character explore. Okay, it's your lead character is the hub of the wheel. Everyone else is the spokes, as it were. And you really need to keep track of which spokes will lead most directly to the hub for the purpose of this particular story. What conundrums do you want them to explore? What aspects of their own personality or aspects of the human condition do you want to explore as a writer, and do you want to get your lead character to think about and contemplate and, you know, ideally have some sort of interaction with? So who it is that you wind up using in any particular story is really at the beck and call of the story itself, because ideally each of the different characters fulfills some sort of function.
So everything stems from the protagonist, just as in Tigerheart, everything stems from Paul, you say?
Pretty much. Yeah, pretty much. You know, there's any number of times in the story where I compare and contrast Paul and the boy in terms of what Paul's idea of heroism is versus what the boy's idea of heroism is. That the boy goes adventuring in order to please himself. Paul goes adventuring in order to please his mother. Two totally different concepts. One is self-directed, one is altruistic. And to me, the best moments in the book stem from the scenes where Paul and the boy are having arguments about what it means to be a hero, what it means to be a grown-up, what it means to take responsibility. These are things that not only does Paul have to explore, but ultimately it's what the reader needs to explore. It is the aspect of the human condition that Tigerheart is trying to comment on. Rather than treating the notion that growing up is a bad thing to be avoided at all costs and is inherently evil, as Barry seemed to put forward, rather we explore the notion that growing up can be a wonderful thing if you're willing to own up the responsibilities, because growing up means that you start to take a larger view of the world, and that that is an inherently positive thing. I mean, as much as Barry seemed to be not thrilled about the prospect of growing up, he didn't seem to be all that keen on children either. Do you remember what the last line of Peter Pan is? "And so it will always be for as long as the children are gay and heartless." There's a third word in there. Are gay and something and heartless. You know, heartless? Oh my God. You know, that's not a particularly, you know, positive commentary on children either. And, you know, I think that Tigerheart has ultimately a more upbeat aspect to it. I would like to think so. Then again, I didn't have as many things go wrong in my life as James Barry did.
Yeah. Well, the boy also has a, at least I perceived it a little bit, a vague Bush-like quality to him. At one point, he does
George
say...
George Bush?
Yeah, he says stay the course at one point, and there's this warlike atmosphere.
Yeah, but he's on a ship.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's be fair.
That's true. I thought of that. But I'm wondering if this was a sort of double entendre in any manner.
No, I wasn't really thinking about the boy as... That's something you read into it. Yeah. I wasn't really thinking about the boy as George Bush. No, George Bush does make a cameo appearance in the book, so to speak, but it ain't the boy.
Gotcha. The other question I wanted to ask you really quickly are... particularly in relation to comic books, is the influence of sales upon your work. I mean, I think particularly...
I wouldn't know.
Well, I mean...
if I get some, we'll
I know, but I'm thinking in terms of, for example, during the DC run of Fallen Angel, in the fifth issue, there is an opening sequence that is really quite incredible with a topless Lee battling Slate. And I was curious if the low sales for Fallen Angel influenced that particular scene in any way to kind of spice things up.
No, because keep in mind that when I wrote the script for issue number 5, issue number 1 wasn't even on the stands yet.
Ah, okay.
So I couldn't really, you know, it wasn't like I was going, let's throw in some TNA because the book needs it.
Yeah.
I mean, let's keep in mind that we actually depicted Lee nude in issue 2.
Yes.
So, you know, and no, it was the reason that I had Lee being topless in that was it actually just stemmed out of that here's a woman who is scrubbing down, trying to just get blood out of her costume while leaning over a bathtub. She's alone in her house. Why would she be wearing anything?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, perfectly honest, I could have had her stark naked. It would have, it just would have made eminent sense to me. The fact that Slate then walked in, and the fact that she was not in the least bit, oh my God, trying to cover up, but instead putting his head through the wall, I thought said something about her. There was no cries of modesty or anything. There was just, you know.
Well, Slate's part, there were a few.
Yeah, there was the fallen angel going, you son of a bitch, and she slams him through a wall.
Yeah.
You know, she made making no attempt to cover up. I thought that that said something about her. I wasn't thinking about it particularly in terms of sales.
I'm wondering, though, if there has ever been an instance in your comic career in which an editor has come to you and said, hey, Peter, the sales for this particular title are flagging. What can we do to raise things up? Is this ever an influence?
Of course it's an influence. I mean, look, when it comes to particularly my work-for-hire material, my job at the end of the day is to do two things. As far as the publisher is concerned, this is purely my job as far as the publisher is concerned, okay? Number one, turn in a publishable script. And number two, do everything that is within my power to write a book that will sell. Okay? I mean, because I could turn in absolutely kick-ass scripts that aren't going to sell for crap.
Yeah.
But I feel that that to a certain degree, part of my job is to try and do everything I can to keep the book marketable. I've been doing that my entire comic book career. When I was writing Hulk, there you go, thank you. When I was writing Hulk during my initial 12-year run, I regularly had access to sales figures ahead of time, 3-4 months ahead of time, because that's how far ahead we were soliciting. And they were incredibly instructional, because what would happen is I would be aware of a sales drop months ahead of time. And if so that, you know, I would have the Hulk in a particular incarnation. going through a particular series of events. If I saw sales starting to flag, I'd say to myself, okay, that incarnation of the Hulk seems to be running its course. Time to come up with something else. So if you want to have an idea of when sales were starting to drop during my 12-year run at any particular time, look to a point where the Hulk undergoes some sort of transformation, backdate yourself about 6 months, and that's when I was looking at the sales figures going, okay, we have a drop.
Yes. Okay?
The problem nowadays is that we don't know sales figures until after the book's already on the stands. So instead of having a three to four month early warning system so that I can course correct ahead of time, we are always behind the curve by 3 to 4 months because we don't know the sales numbers until at least 2 months after the book has come out. I mean, you know, we see the sales numbers on ICV2 or whatever it is. That's when I see the sales numbers.
Yeah.
We see those sales numbers come out 2 to 3 months after the book is on the stand, plus they're already soliciting 3 months down the line.
Yeah.
So you can find yourself in free fall before you're aware of the fact that you've got any kind of attrition problem. Because every book's always going to have attrition. Every book.
Yeah.
Every book. There's no stopping it. There's always going to be, you know, you're going to get a build, and then it's going to level off, and then it's going to start to drop. Always, no matter what the book is, always. The thing that I was able to do on Hulk is when I saw it start to drop, I would say, okay, time to do something different, and I could come up with a new angle on the Hulk that would goose sales because we have people going, whoa, they're doing something new and different with the Hulk. Let's see. As it is, I can't course correct, and it's incredibly frustrating.
But I'm also wondering if some of the stuff that you do with, say, Fallen Angel, I mean, you had a post on your blog recently in which a gentleman couldn't purchase it from his neighborhood comic store because he was the only person purchasing the issue.
Buying it, yeah.
So for something like this, is Fallen Angel more of a unfettered territory to
it's
write in?
It's unfettered territory. That doesn't mean I don't want to see sales be brought up.
Yeah.
For example, I just did this... This major storyline that's shaking up the status quo of Bete Noire. I brought war to Bete Noire.
Yeah.
And just totally kicked over the apple cart. I'm hoping that doing a storyline like that will attract readers, will get people, you know, finding out about it. The problem that we're dealing with is the signal-to-noise ratio. There's so much material out there and so many people clamoring for the public's attention that it's difficult to get any attention for your book at all. I mean, how do you get people jazzed up about problems in Bete Noire when every third item out there on news services is about Skrulls invading?
Yeah.
Or DC having yet another crisis?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It is extremely problematic.
But I mean, where does the niche audience for something like Fallen Angel fall into place? Because I mean, you're always going to have
a built-in audience, but the problem is going to be, is it a sufficient audience to keep the book profitable as far as the publisher is concerned?
Yeah.
I mean, the money that I make off of Fallen Angel is negligible.
Yeah.
I get far less money for Fallen Angel than any other book that I do, but I do it willingly because it's a labor of love.
The other question I had, sort of in relation to this, was also, I wanted to actually ask you about the role of the editor. This rarely gets talked about in comic book writing. Some people accuse certain editors of having editorial interference along these lines of trying to influence sales. And you yourself have had a number of run-ins over the years until you went exclusive with certain terms with Marvel in 2006.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, have you just reached a point where you could essentially, you're happy with what you're turning out and you don't have these great editorial mishaps along the lines of Captain Marvel? Or is it a scenario in which you just have to kind of work for this? Or is there constant a constant battle of attrition here for making a title work?
Did you ever hear of a Tennessee Williams play called A Period of Adjustment?
I have not read it, so.
It's a play about several different couples, a newly married couple, a couple who's been married for a while, and a couple who's been married for forever. And one of the running lines is that one of the characters keeps saying, you're just going through a little period of adjustment, right? And it's happening with everybody. And the theme of the play, the message of the play, is that marriage is a constant period of adjustment. always. It's never ending. Same thing. That's what working with editors in the comic book field is. Same thing. It's a constant period of adjustment. There's always going to be debates. There's always going to be discussions. Let's keep in mind, though, that editors are even more under the gun to monitor sales than any of the writers are.
Yeah.
Because if ultimately a book is just simply not cutting it sales-wise, it's going to be canceled, which is not a fun thing for the editor because essentially it means that he's failed to make the book profitable for the company. Turn out enough failed books, and your head's going on the chopping block, you know?
Yeah.
With a writer, there's always other people we can blame. But, you know, the editor, everybody's got, it goes back to what I was saying before, everyone has their own story, everybody has their own problems. There can be some editors who are way too hands-on. Generally, I don't wind up working with them, either because they have the reputation and I stay the hell away from them, or I have the reputation and they stay the hell away from me.
Yeah.
You know, the concept of, oh God, we don't want to have to work, we don't want to have to deal with Peter David because he's going to, you know, fight for what he wants to do, as opposed to writing with a tyro. Or not necessarily a tyro. Dan Slott told a hysterical story of how twice within a 2-week period, an editor at Marvel and an editor at DC told him in regards to a particular development that he had in a script. Remember, two different scripts, two different editors, two different companies. They said to him, if you were Peter David, I'd let you get away with this.
Yeah.
Which I told Dan was really interesting because I told him that I had written a script where an editor told me, if you were Dan Slott, I'd make you cut it. Now, that part wasn't true, but I thought it was interesting, you know, the notion that there are editors who basically, you know, feel that if it's me, they'll let me get away with it. Maybe because they feel that I can carry it off. Maybe because they feel that having my name on the book has some degree of value to it, and therefore the readers will let me get away with it. You know, that kind of thing. Maybe being Peter David gets me that latitude. If so, well, that's nice because I've been working in the comic industry for, God, over a quarter of a century, so it's nice to know there's some perks with being me.
But everybody may have their own unique story, but everybody does not necessarily have their own unique saleable story. And sales,
no.
Sales enter this equation of uniqueness, and so how do you keep things unique and commercial at the same time?
By dancing as fast as I can. By trying to see what's going to work, what isn't going to work, by using the experience that I've developed over the years about seeing what flies with the fans and what doesn't, and God knows I'm not always right. I come up with stuff that I think is going to be incredibly commercial and it crashes and burns. Or I will come up with story developments that I think are going to kick ass and people just reject it wholesale. I mean, there's no exact science to it. For instance, right now I'm writing She-Hulk.
Yeah.
Okay? Over in the Hulk comic book, Jeff Loeb has had She-Hulk gather together a group of female heroes to bring them together as an army to go up against the Red Hulk. The editor said to me, informed me that this was happening and said, you know, we can make use of these characters who are being collectively referred to as the Lady Liberators. And I said, great. Why? Because I know it'll help sell the book.
Yeah.
So lo and behold, in issue 34, which is the script that I just finished this morning, I have She-Hulk calling in the Lady Liberators. I developed a storyline that would very specifically cater to this particular group of characters, and I'm letting them go. Now, is part of that commercially driven? Hell yeah. Sure, I want to see sales go up. But I wouldn't do it if I didn't think it could be a good story. I mean, because that's where the balance has to be. You can't just say, I'm going to do this because it's commercial, and turn out crap that doesn't work. Because what will happen is, you'll get people then buying the book, because they'll say, oh, he's bringing in these characters, that sounds incredibly interesting. But if the story's shite, then they're going to feel tricked. And they were tricked. And they're going to be resentful. And yeah, you may have had them for that one issue, but you can sure as hell bet they're not coming back for the next one. So ultimately, you do have to find that balance. You have to find out what works for you in terms of commerciality. Is that a word?
Commercialism, I suppose.
No, that wasn't what I was going for. For commercial success as opposed to creative success. You cannot sell out one for the other.
Got you. Well, Peter, it was a pleasure chatting with you.
You too.
Thanks so much.